Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by hosts of the Five Live Breakfast Show, Rachel Burden and Nikki Campbell.
Delighted to be discussing something else today.
I know.
Other than the other B word, as you so aptly referred to when we came in.
Delighted to be discussing something.
Yes.
And all the other tracks.
Yeah. And we're also joined by Maxwell.
Of course we are.
What's
Maxwell he named? Doesn't look particularly interested in our conversation
no.
so far, but then we
he's only sleeping.
So today we're talking about the outtakes on the 50th anniversary Abbey Road Super Deluxe Edition, as it was known. But before we get to the new version, what are your thoughts on the original?
God, I can't remember when I first heard it. But I mean, it is probably up there. You know, you have those kind of internal arguments with yourself the whole time about, you know, if you were absolutely forced, otherwise someone was going to steal one of your children to name your favourite Beatles album, then I think I might ultimately go with Abbey Road.
Really?
Yeah, don't sound surprised. I think that's probably... Isn't that obvious?
Revolver?
No, definitely Abbey Road over Revolver. What about you, Nicky?
I veer. Different day, different album. Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road, with the Beatles. I'm all over the place. But Abbey Road is their cleanest, isn't it? Sound-wise. And that's why I think this remix, this remastering is interesting. It takes us further, and you hear things you haven't heard before, but it is not as radical or revolutionary to the ears as the Sgt. Pepper remastering. Because this was, it was on the cusp of the 1970s and that kind of new era, oral era for recorded music. And Abbey Road has a sheen and a polish that to previous albums perhaps don't have to the same degree. No less brilliant for it and no less of a fantastic listening experience. But this was, it was almost an album of a different era.
Yeah, yeah. Because you interviewed Giles for the 50th anniversary. What was that like?
Oh, I was in a studio with him for 2 hours, playing Beatles records and discussing the Beatles with him.
Right.
It was terrible. I just wanted to get out.
Yeah, I imagine.
God, when's this going to end? God.
It did like it could have gone on for a couple of more hours, I reckon.
Yeah, it was just gorgeous. And his take on it was, on what we're going to discuss, the outtakes... He just discovered, listening to track after track and original after original and studio take after studio take, that bond of brothers in the studio, how close they were, how bonded they were, how great the banter was and the warmth and the understanding. Whatever was happening outside the studio, whatever legal randals were encircling them and ultimately wrecking their relationships, there was magic going on in there. Not just the music. Did you get the sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I find it a very emotional listen, Abbey Road. And I think because, you know, we obviously know it was their final studio album and they didn't necessarily know that at the time. But because you listen with the knowledge that it was, you put enormous emotional significance on every single word that's written and every single musical gesture. And it does feel like... a tying up of loose ends to me, and I think the outtakes kind of confirm all that. And as Nikki references, the unique alchemy that was the Beatles seems to be alive and well, and you hear it in their voices. And honestly, sometimes I know it sounds ridiculous, I just want to cry. I want to cry when I hear them sound happy and they're buzzing off each other. And you know, they've got that that kind of, you know, their own language, you know, little references and everything that made them just still as a unit in some ways untouchable, even though as we know things were kind of falling apart a bit around them.
I want to review the banter as much as the music.
Yes, yeah,
because I think Rachel's absolutely right. Some of the banter says so much between the lines, what they're saying, the way they're saying it, the mode and means of communication with each other, that the telepathy of people who've done so much together, been through so much together, and had that alchemy That was the word that you used.
Mark Lewisohn's been on tour for the last couple of months. He's basically bringing more insight into the recording sessions and what was going on and the relationships between them. And they were still best friends.
They were best friends in the studio.
Yeah.
Out the studio. Very often, they couldn't stand each other out of the studio. But it's appropriate we've got us to do this.
Because we can't stand each other out of the studio.
But in the studio, there's an alchemy. Great banter.
I think you said your sort of occasional chat will be about the Beatles when you're off air. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there are lots of... We have a kind of few common references, Nicky and I, that inevitably kind of recur and little things pop up, and Nicky's heard stuff and he'll tell me about stuff and he'll make references, and you know, he'll kind of throw in obscure Beatles references to conversations while we're on air, and I'm always kicking myself when I don't get them, you know. You have to be really mentally sharp.
Yeah. There's something in a book actually, and it says that most people downloading Here Comes the Sun are late teenagers or people in their early 20s.
Yes, yeah.
My kids love the Beatles. I mean, the demographic is... It keeps on churning, doesn't it?
Yeah. I want you
so bad, baby. I want you. I want you so bad. It's driving me mad. It's driving me mad.
I Want You, She's So Heavy.
We start with... Wow. What a song. There's two CDs of outtakes, and this is track one.
Yeah, when you got the album, Chris, did you go to the outtakes first, or did you
yes.
go... I love it! So you listened to the outtakes before you listened to the remastered album.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, John's voice on this, it's just astonishing, and I just love it. It's kind of raunchiest, sexiest, rawest kind of peak. Don't you think? What did you think?
It's never been one of my favourites. It is now. I love the extra rawness of it and the looseness of it. And I was just mesmerised listening to it. Billy Preston just goes crazy. Why didn't they use that?
I have a theory that Moog, or as it's pronounced, Moog.
Is it?
If you pronounce it Moog, you'll get some complaints.
Jacob Rees-Moog. Jacob Rees-Moog.
Please say that tomorrow. Please say that. And I've got a feeling, pun, that Billy... I mean, they've been working with him for a while on the Let It Be, Get Back stuff. And it was Mike Vickers from Manfred Mann who helped with doing all the programming. Because he was one of the first people to buy a Moog. And I just think once they heard that, I thought, oh, yeah, let's get rid of Billy and play around with this.
Wasn't it George's Moog, though? Wasn't it?
Yes.
Wasn't he the one who had it? And I was hearing, again, on one of the Radio 2 programmes, that George Martin had gone over and spent 2 weeks in San Francisco learning how to use this contraption, which it was, wasn't it? It's not a synthesizer as we would know it now.
No, you literally had to program it. So I think that was it. But Billy shines on this, doesn't he?
But they asked George Martin which is best, and he knows exactly. The magical George Martin ears, he knows exactly which take has had a good bit there and which is the previous take that's had a good bit, which reminds us of the famous story when they were recording Cilla Black's Alfie and Burt Bacharach was there. And they were on take 64 or something. And Cilla Black had that softness of voice when she was at her best that suited the song so well. So we're on take 64 and Burt Bacharach said, "Have we got the magic yet? Have we got the magic yet?" And George Martin said, "Yeah, take 4.
He just knew.
Wow.
And that's, the Martin ears, that he comes straight in and says, "Well, we had a good bit in that one and we had a good bit in the previous one before."
Yeah.
But extraordinarily on this bit, the drama around it, there's a play within a play, isn't there? Because they recorded it at Trident Studios, Wardour Street, this one, and there's a complaint.
That's right, I love this.
Yeah. From somebody outside about the noise that they're making.
Yeah.
A couple of things there. I said, John, very reasonably... Not very sort of rock and roll, a Lost Weekend at all. John very reasonably says, "Okay, well, we'll do one more loud one."
Yeah, and then we'll play it quiet.
And then we'll play it quietly. You know, it's being reasonable. He says, "Who on earth?" But listen, Someone's complained. It's like, is this the same person that complained about them playing on the roof?
Yes. It could be, wasn't it? Just this one person.
I'd love to know.
Who is this person?
Following them round.
Somebody should go out and say to them, it's the Beatles!
Yeah, because Jeff Emmerich's very kind of diplomatic, isn't he? So, John, is it possible you could... Yeah. You know, you've got the job of telling the Beatles to turn themselves down.
So there's one more loud one, and they do one more loud one.
Yeah, and they do one more loud one.
Yeah, and that's it. There's a fine line between the end of Let It Be and Get Back to this album, and a lot of the tracks they first recorded, they were thinking that it was going to be for Let It Be, or Get Back, as it was called at the time. John did an interview in The NME saying, yeah, we've nearly finished the next album, but we want to do 14 tracks, so we're going to go in the studio and do a few more. So potentially this could have been deemed for Get Back. So there was no, right, let's record Abbey Road. It kind of evolved into that. But he also interestingly mentioned, we're thinking about doing sort of medleys. So even, you know...
Even at that early stage.
At that early stage, yeah.
The idea was there. And that kind of goes back to that idea of there not being a moment where they said, right, let's get together for one. I mean, I know that Paul was keen to get back into Abbey Road and get George Martin on board again, but it wasn't like, here is our final album, we're all going to get together, here's the start date. It did evolve, as you say, a bit more subtly than that.
Yeah.
Even though then it became something incredibly sort of well thought through and polished in the end.
Mark Lewisohn's on tour as well, and he's saying about, they had that meeting after the album came out in September 69, they were talking about the next album. You know, George's come on, we'll give him four tracks. I'll have four tracks, Paul will have four tracks, give Ringo one as well.
Paul's,
you know,
quite disparaging of George, isn't he?
He was.
But yeah. Paul's apparently stoned.
Well, Mark Lewisohn did a preview of the talk, and I was actually invited. I was, you know, one of the many that were. Couldn't make it. I was like, oh man, gutted. And apparently he played it through there. We saw his, I think it was the second or third show after he did that in London, and he said, unfortunately, powers that be, I can't play much of this tape that you've all read about. So the next day it was everywhere, it was all in the press, transcribing everything. And I think someone, possibly at Apple, has said, no, you're not doing that. So you get a snippet, but you read in The Guardian or whatever it was pretty well what was said.
Yeah.
But they said, yeah, Paul sounded a bit dozy, I think was the word.
I wonder if he felt slightly threatened by George, because I mean his contribution to Abbey Road was unlike any contribution he made to any of the other albums, wasn't it? So,
but it's peak Paul as well, isn't it?
It is peak Paul, and it's peak John. But peak Paul in the sense, would it be fair to say that he kind of controlled more of that album than any other previous one, and drove it?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, because John wasn't there for a lot of it. George wasn't there for a bit of it, so he was the only one that was there. He lived down
constantly,
the road.
Constantly, yeah, in and out.
So he's always the first one there.
But I Want to Hold Your Hand to I Want You, She's So Heavy. What we're talking about, 4 years?
Not just that. How old were they? They were like 25, 26.
Yeah. Ringo celebrated his 29th birthday. He was the oldest one during this album.
So George would have been...
26.
Young. Yeah. I mean, it is astonishing, the kind of maturity of their song. They don't look 24, do they? Also, when you look at the pictures in the book, they look way older than that. They've lived the life by then, there's no doubt about it. But but the kind of sort of emotional maturity of them, what they've been through, I mean, they just lived in double time, I think. It was, and yet then look, they just look so sweet.
Brilliant photos. They are such good photos, we've never seen before. But the overarching thing for me about the outtakes, listening to the atmosphere and being in there and the immersive nature of it, is John loving being a Beatle.
Yeah.
And all the stuff about the soul, you know, distant, apathetic, not interested anymore, John. He's loving it. He's a part of it. He's at the very heart of it.
Please don't wake me up too late. Tomorrow comes and I will not be late. Late today when it becomes tomorrow, I will leave and go away. Goodbye, 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 goodbye.
Track two, which is the home demo of Goodbye by Paul.
This is quintessential, effortless peak Macca ability to just do melody. Not, but it's a beautiful melody, but the song is unpredictable as well. In the sort of time signatures and the way it goes and some of the chord changes. Yes. It's just sublime. You've heard it before, though, on bootleg, have you?
It's been around a while, but never in this quality. Mm. It's obviously from Mary Hopkin, but yeah, his voice is like a butterfly. It's just, I agree. I think 68 to 69, his voice, he could do anything he wanted. He's effectively singing a female vocal.
10 key. Yeah. It's Mary Hopkin, isn't it? What did you think?
It took me completely by surprise. I hadn't heard it before, so it was a total gem. I mean, it's discovering an undiscovered Beatles track, isn't it? Even though it was written for someone else. It's more Paul than Paul. I wasn't expecting it. And I thought, clearly, obviously, wasn't something that was ever intended for Abbey Road. So it sort of slightly knocked me, because I was like, oh my, was this something that they were playing around with? So, because it doesn't quite sit within that story, obviously. Yeah. But no, it's lovely. Just the fact he can just knock these things off without really thinking about it too much. Oh, here's one I wrote on the toilet.
Mary Visconti.
Yes.
She married Tony Visconti, Bowie's producer.
Oh, yeah.
She was a winner of Opportunity Knox, the X Factor of its day, one might say. Mm. Big talent competition. Quite a lot of famous people came out of it. Les Dawson.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
A few others. Yeah. So she won that. And then she was signed to Apple, and Paul McCartney very much took control. I think ultimately she was uncomfortable with that. She thought he was a bit controlling. Goodbye was a great vehicle for her. Are you aware of the Bowie album Low?
No.
Sound and Vision?
No. Don't ask me about Bowie. Okay. I know nothing.
Sound and Vision. Do 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 do. That bit.
Uh-huh.
that's Mary Hopkin.
Okay.
Isn't it?
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave now. You know I believe in how.
Another demo, Something. This is George on his birthday.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the most beautiful songs ever written, isn't it? Imagine someone wrote that for you. Just imagine.
She's not talking into the microphone.
No, I know.
She's never done this before.
She's directing me. Stop it.
Into the mic.
Nikki knows this song was sung at my wedding. I love it for all different reasons. We actually had a gospel version of it sung at the wedding, which was incredible. But I could listen to this in whatever way, shape or form George decided to play with it and still absolutely love it. And I'm really torn with that little, I don't know, you technical geeky bit here, but is it that little middle eight bit where he sings Woman of Mine, or that Woman of Mine, how I love that Woman of Mine? I'm really torn as to whether I like it or it just makes me slightly cringe. I don't know. What do you think?
He's just messing about. He's just trying to get the song right. And I think he's just improvising what might well be an instrumental bit. And I don't think he was ever serious about embracing the lyric that he was scatting.
I think it's written
in basically scatting, really, isn't it?
But he's written it in the lyrics here that they've reproduced in the book.
Oh, really? Has he?
Yeah, I think so. Let me...
I love that woman or something.
Yeah, you know, I love that woman of mine. And I love her all of the time. You see, the problem I have with it is... His lyrics are so, this is going to sound really pretentious, but his lyrics for this are so profound, they're so beautiful, they're so sort of ethereal, they're so kind of, I can't quite put my finger on it.
Yes.
And it's all about that, I just can't tell you what it is, it's just something. And then when he goes, oh, I love that woman of mine, it's like, nah, you're kind of back to basics there, we know that stuff. Keep with the kind of, I can't quite, it's just something so incredible, I can't even work
it's
it out.
It's fine, they
it
cut it. They didn't use it.
I know.
It's okay.
I know, thanks. I'll calm down now.
And Frank Sinatra, of course, covered it, didn't he? It's perfect for Sinatra, some of those lines. You know, you stick around now. It may show. Didn't he say, you stick around, Jack?
Yes, he did, yes. Mm. And he also said it was his favourite Lennon McCartney song as well. Really, really pissed George off.
I think I'm right in saying that when George Harrison performed the song in Tokyo, he, I think it says in the book actually, George Harrison said, "You stick around, Jack." It missed us, might show in one of his performances. Yeah, reffing Frank.
Yeah,
Because I don't like strumming on electric guitar. I wish he'd done it on acoustic.
Yeah, he started doing this during the Get Back sessions, and he played it to John. And he was saying, "Yeah, I need some help with the lyrics. It's something in the way she moves." And he said, "I can't quite get it." And John suggested, "Attracts me like a cauliflower." And says, "Use that, and then eventually you'll come up with the attracts me like whatever." Mm. And George's suggestion was, "Pomegranate attracts me like a pomegranate." And he, I don't know how serious he was, but that he was using John still at that point, you know, in 69, saying, "John, can you give us a hand with this?" Mm. And he was that insecure. He gave it to Joe Cocker first.
Did he?
Yeah, Joe Cocker recorded it first. But he didn't release the album until after Abbey Road.
Ah, right.
Because he was that, you know, how can you be insecure
crazy
about that song? It's astonishing.
You're asking me when my love grows. I don't know. I don't know.
There's one sublime bit on it, though, when he sings for the first time. "You're asking me, will my love grow?" And his voice kind of breaks a bit.
Cracks.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because what we do know, he doesn't know, but what we do know is it's all going to come crashing down around him. Don't mean to laugh at that. It's a tragic love tale.
Yeah, of course.
But
at least Eric wasn't doing the guitar solo.
Yeah, true.
Orcs, I think they say. The kids these days.
"Un string avec kaput mal."
Okay. It got a bit faster, Ringo.
Okay, George.
Okay.
Standing in the dockets of Ham.
And then we have the Ballad of John and Yoko. This is take 7. And it's just John and Paul.
Oh, I love this. I mean, I just love everything about this. But my favourite bit in the outtake is when they refer to each other as George and Ringo. And that is was one of my kind of almost, you know, well up moments, because it's just so sweet. And I love the whole story behind it. And I love the idea of John coming back and just being like, I've got this song. I absolutely have to get it down. You're just going to have to come down to the studio. We're going to have to just crack on, do it ourselves. And the two of them, and particularly because, you know, their story became so fractured, didn't it? That their relationship, and it feels like this was almost like the one final blast, just the two of them together,
yeah,
coming up with something, you know, brilliant and sort of musically unique.
I can't help doing the harmonies. Do you find yourself doing
yes
that?
Yeah.
When he says, "The men from the press," I could, "The men from the press."
Yes.
"Success."
Yeah.
"To have the both of you back."
Yeah. You can hear what's missing from this version. You can hear Paul's input, because that would have all been Paul. Paul was always the one polishing, well, not the turd, but, you know.
Yes!
But he was
there
always
the one. There were no turds, ever!
But with the
it's
piano
a turd
at the end.
I'm thinking of.
I would say there's one big omission from this, which I think, again, you would love, is "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number."
Yes!
Because they were doing the vocals for that around this time as well. And you've got Mal Evans digging gravel. And they were just having such a good laugh.
Yeah.
So if you're going to include "Goodbye," put "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number" in there as well.
But which is the track on here, which is the outtake on here that really reminds me of that, where they're messing about a bit and doing...
Oh, yes.
Because, that, and it, the few times I've listened to it, every time I thought, that really reminds me of You Know My Name. So yeah, if it was around
there is,
the same.
I can't think, there is, he does but that. On one of,
and they kind of, you know what I mean? I can't remember which outtake it is, but it's there.
It is there.
Well, that's, all right, okay, you win.
Yeah.
I'm in love with you. This was a moment in time and a moment in history, the Ballad of Johnny and Yoko as well, wasn't it? They were they were persecuted by the press. They were the Harry and Meghan of their day, weren't they?
They were.
The press having a go at them everything they did, and they were jetting off to places asking for peace, asking for peace and love and harmony, and imagine no possessions with their massive houses and jets and cars. But I love them. It's like hearing them there together, it's like the day they met, isn't it, at the Fete. Walton?
Yeah.
You know, that it's a continuum from that. There they are again, towards the end, with each other, playing and loving each other's playing and loving being with each other, playing with each other, writing with each other. And I think there's just something so magical about that. And when Bob Harris arranged me, because he knows the curator of John Lennon's house in Liverpool, Mendips?
Yes, yeah.
And I went round, I had a private trip round.
Really?
And he said at the end, lovely guy, do you play the guitar? I said, yeah, sort of. So he gave me a guitar and he said, go and stand in the porch and check out the acoustic of the porch, because that's where John and Paul wrote all their songs. An amazing acoustic. And I went in there and I played Blue Moon. It was astonishing. I was in absolute dreamland, and I've never heard an acoustic like it. And Paul, I think Bob mentioned it to Paul in an interview, and Paul said, I'd love to go and record some stuff in that porch at some time. Yeah.
Sorry, this is my problem. This is why I'm not a professional. I get lost in when people are talking.
I've got the picture.
Have you?
It's okay to get lost. Yeah. That's what a good professional does. It's fine.
Is it? Yeah, oh, right, okay. Keeps people speaking, did it? What? Really?
Funnily enough, that story reminds me of the, what's it called? Carpool Karaoke James Corden did with Paul. And he takes him back to Paul's old house, and Paul goes into his toilet and says, this is where I used to sit and play the guitar because of the acoustics in his little toilet. Yeah. Maybe not as good as John's porch. I want a love that's right, but right is only half of what's wrong. I want a short-haired girl, sometimes wears it twice as long. Now I'm stepping out this old brown shoe. Baby, I'm in love with you. So glad you came here, won't be the same now, I'm telling you.
Next we have Old Brown Shoe, and this is take two. And again, there's no Ringo. Ringo's filming Magic Christian at this point. He's got Paul on the drums as well.
He loves a bit of dissonance, doesn't he, George?
He does.
And it's really kind of raw and obvious here on this outtake.
Yeah.
But I quite like it because you're forced to listen to the keyboard kind of melody because it's so prominent in it, and I just found myself meandering along with that when I was listening to this. I mean, I'm not a massive, it's not
Old Brown Shoe person.
No, I'm not.
It's a bit of a skipper for me. It's interesting, isn't it? We discussed 33 and a third. Chris, I was on the podcast doing that, and I absolutely loved it. I think this is just the best fun you can have. And when we discussed 33 and a third, I mentioned the track on there, See Yourself, which,
yes,
for all the world to me, sounded like a song that should have been recorded by the Beatles. Mm. And See Yourself is an infinitely superior song to Old Brown Shoe.
He had so many songs that he'd written back in 66 to 69 that didn't appear till like 20 years later. Because he was then writing new songs, and thinking, I'll save that for the next album. So he must have had such a stockpile.
Oh, darling,
we have Oh Darling, take four, more Billy Preston.
Now go on, you start.
I love the fact that John Lennon, years later in an interview, said he should have sung it. He said, but it was Paul's song, so he did it, but really I should have sung it. It would have been much better.
Probably would.
There's a touch of the Ono Band about it, isn't there? You could have had that little slap echo going, and I can hear John doing it. It would have been perfect for John.
I think the outtake here, what stood out for me was Paul's vocal on it.
Yes.
The quality of his vocal was, whether I just don't pick it out in the final remastered version or whatever it is, but I kind of got quite absorbed in that and quite like, what's different about his voice? I can't put my finger on it, but it just sounds different. It sounds rich. I don't know if he's opening his throat more, opening his mouth more in order to get that sound.
Yeah.
But because I love Paul when he goes for it. I really do.
Yeah.
And the contrast to kind of, you know, Maxwell Silver Hammer or whatever. But yeah. So I love listening to it. And, you know, in my teenage years, when you'd be listening to these things at home on your cassette player or whatever, and you'd be thinking that they were singing it to you. So that was one of them that I would just imagine.
I get that with Octopus's Garden.
Yeah, I can see that. That, and funnily enough, Maybe I'm Amazed. Those two, which I think they're really similar, aren't they?
He's not going for it here, though, is he? This isn't intended to be a take.
No,
he's holding back, which is quite nice.
Mm. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what makes his voice sound slightly different. I don't know.
But it is, yeah. He hasn't got that growl
that
he's got on the final version. But he's just playfully hitting falsetto. He's not even going to falsetto. He's just getting that high in his natural voice. His voice was just so astonishing at this time.
He does do that thing occasionally, doesn't he? On his...
Yes.
I used to be able to do it. He just goes up to the falsetto when he's playing around with his voice.
Yeah. It's about an octave higher than that, isn't it? It's
just like that.
Yeah, an outtake.
But you can hear on this outtake where he's going to end up. You know, you can see, as you say, he is experimenting, but you can see he's kind of feeling his way to the final version because it's not a million miles from it at all.
No. And it's also, and you've got Billy Preston on here as well at the end, and that just that organ. I think Billy has been the highlight for this for me because he was uncredited on the original album.
Why?
I don't know.
I mean, that's a travesty, really, isn't it, considering his kind of musical contributions and the difference he made. He wasn't just a session musician. He was much more than that.
He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden, in the shade. I'd ask my friend to come. Sorry, did I miss? I went wrong. Did I?
I thought I heard you singing Octopus's Garden with John.
I think I went into... I'd asked my friends earlier, I think. Or you all came late.
And talking of Octopus's Garden, we have take 9, in which Ringo actually forgets his own song.
He gets where he is in the song, doesn't he? Yeah.
And then tries to blame it on the others. Which I love.
I think the most joyful thing about this, apart from what happens and the mistake, is that laugh at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it just says everything about the atmosphere in those sessions. They're totally at ease with each other, like they always were.
Now, you're good, because I wasn't quite sure whether that was George or Ringo. I couldn't pick that out, but you recognised.
Hmm.
You can identify the Beatles from their laughs.
Absolutely.
That's impressive, isn't it?
That's good.
And also the melody, am I right, is slightly different here from the final version. The introduction, the intro melody bit.
Yeah.
Which I it's like frustrating. It's like, why, something's different. What's different? That's different.
What, the lick, the riff, the country?
Diddly, 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 do that bit.
Yeah. Well, it's a standard kind of country and western guitar tropes, aren't they?
Yeah. I think George should have got a credit on this because he's playing it during the Let It Be film. And Ringo's kind of playing these chords. And then George, well, why don't you just play the chords that eventually end up on the album?
Really?
And I think George was too graceful. Yeah.
Don't
put my name on it.
I do think it is my favourite Ringo track of all Beatles.
Three
tracks.
With a little help from my friend?
No, that he wrote.
Oh, that he wrote. Right.
Yeah. Because...
Don't Pass Me By, not a fan.
With the greatest Beatles lyric ever.
Oh, yes.
She was in a car crash and she lost her hair. Yeah. What? Why? How? no, yeah, so I did, it's fun. It's fun. But it, as Nicky says, it's the atmosphere that's conveyed around it from the outtake.
Yes.
It's a good example of a song, though, that on its own had there never been the Beatles, and merely Ringo Starr, had it appeared on some kind of Ringo Starr project, you would have thought, what's that? But because it's in the context of the Beatles, it has that magic.
Mm.
And because it's in its place, on a podium with the rest of these songs, on a plinth on this album, it just sounds, well, it transcends the song that it is, doesn't it?
Mm. And also, with these songs, you have to recognise that they are a gateway song for young Beatles enthusiasts.
Yeah.
You know, like Yellow Submarine, Octopus's Garden. You know, if you can get your six-year-old singing that, then you can draw them in until they never see a way out. Yeah, exactly.
It's great being a Beatles fan, everybody.
Yeah.
We'll never
There's a
leave.
Picture of Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
You never give me your money. And again, this is the one that John was kind of alluding to when he was talking about the segue on the Get Back album.
He says, what, it's 2:30 in the morning exactly, take 36. And they're messing around, and that's where he does the, who did that song? All right, okay, you win. I'm in love with you. Because he's going, all right, okay, you win. And they're messing about, you've got the studio ambience, and then he does the first take, and then they turn the thing off. And then, magic. You never get, and it's just perfection. I was playing it the other day with the kids, and I said, listen to this, all this studio banter. And then that started. Bum, 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 ba-da. And they stopped. Everything stopped, and they just listened when his voice came in. And my daughter Bria, who loves the Beatles, she went, ah. Oh.
I was singing it all the way home from Devon today in the car, and my kids just kept telling me to shut up. That's the other side.
But it casts a spell, doesn't it?
Oh, my God, it's magical. It's magical. And again, it's like one of those, to hear it in any form, any which way they want to sing it or put it out there, just gives you another little glimpse, another little insight.
Yeah. I love Kate Robbins, who was on before. He was in. She mentioned this, apparently Paul...
She learned to play it.
Yeah.
Paul he showed her.
Said, oh, I've just written this new song. What do you think of this? But yeah, she learnt it and played it at her piano lessons.
Yeah, and her piano teacher was really impressed.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't sort of...
No.
Well, she says it is actually technically, you know, it's more complex than you think. It sounds simple, like a lot of Paul's songs.
The lyrical imagery is interesting, isn't it? Because it's kind of disjointed, but it works.
Yeah.
And you saw that more and more in Paul's stuff, certainly in the early Wings period. Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, Band on the Run, kind of, what does that mean? That doesn't seem to mean anything. Why does that come up? But it does mean something, and I don't know why it means something.
Yes.
Out of college, money spent, see no future, pay no rent.
All the money's gone, nowhere to go. Any job I got to sack, Monday morning turning back, yellow lorry slow.
Melds together.
Mm. Yeah.
The tapestry works, doesn't it?
Yeah. He was more confident in his lyrics as well, because when he did Hey Jude and he was like, oh, I've got this, the movement you need is on your shoulder, I'll get rid of that. And, no, you won't. Doesn't mean anything, but it's such a powerful lyric.
Simon Rush's favourite Beatles lyric.
Is it really?
Yeah, I interviewed him, we talked about it.
Wow.
And he said, just that, he said, it doesn't mean anything, but it seems to mean everything.
Mm. I just like the idea that you transformed an interview with Seldon Rush.
Yeah, of course he did.
Oh, what do you think about the Beatles?
There wasn't much else to talk about.
Her Majesty's... Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Majesty's a pretty nice girl. Someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
Next we have three takes of Her Majesty. Over to you.
Why?
Why three takes?
Why? Really?
Really what?
Three takes? Do we need three takes?
So I again, I'm cheating here because I was I've been listening back to the Radio 2 programme all about it, and I hadn't heard the story behind this before at all, which was that it was initially part of the medley. And that bit that they recorded three times, it's such a great story, this. You know this, that they just chopped it off the tape, added it onto the end in order to preserve it. And that's how it ended up on the end bit of the album.
Because me and Mr. Mustard, the only place he's ever been, was to go and, what was it, to look at the Queen.
Yeah.
And they thought that worked after that. The Queen reference worked with...
What, going into Her Majesty?
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't know. And it was, his sister Shirley works in a shop. And so they had Shirley originally, but then they changed it to Pam, because Polythene Pam was next, and that gave it a new cohesion.
Gotcha.
I'm right, answer.
Yeah. So it would have been almost a better story.
Paul didn't want it there, did he? Paul said, take it out.
Yeah.
I heard an American podcast not so long ago talking about Abbey Road. It was before the remix. Saying, I'll tell you what it was. They did the 10 worst Beatles songs, and they mentioned Her Majesty. And that's because culturally they just didn't understand it. Culturally, they didn't get the fact that the Beatles and the Queen were interwoven in the fabric of British history and culture. And they didn't understand that it was at the end, because those were the days when they had the... Do they still have the national anthem at the end of Radio 4's broadcasting of a day?
I don't know. I don't listen to Radio 4 very often.
They still... Well, they used to have it. In the cinema in those days, they used to have the national anthem at the end. I remember. I was a little boy going to the cinema. It was the national anthem at the end. Even then, 4 years old, having enjoyed Dumbo very much, I was thinking, what? What's this all about? So, you know, they don't understand. There's lots of lyrics in here, isn't there? They don't understand. We'll talk about it. Let me, Mr. Mustard, and Polythene Pam. She's the kind of a girl that makes the news of the world.
Yeah.
They, Americans, like cultural reference. Wow, the news of the world. Like the news of the whole world.
Little do they know.
Yeah,
but that's the most, like global. The most significant thing about this particular outtake is that you hear the final chord of Her Majesty. Yes.
Three times.
Yeah.
So that, for me, makes it worth it.
Just that one chord. Yeah. It's worth that.
Definitely.
£90.
The other thing Americans don't understand is the cheekiness of it. Britain in the late 20th century, if you had a collage, you'd have John, Paul, George, Ringo and Queen Elizabeth, wouldn't you? They're the big five. Churchill, Blair.
Well, I think we could argue over that another time. That's another podcast.
Nick Clegg.
Possibly.
Also, there was a time when Paul McCartney really was not very cool at all.
Yeah.
And he seems to have kind of, you know, he's been beatified effectively, hasn't he? Something's happened to him. Yeah. The musical Pope in the sky has kind of pointed down at him and said... But I remember, you know, when I first went to see him in concert, when I was at the height of my Beatles mania, my own personal Beatles mania, and it was the Flowers in the Dirt album, and he was there in his flowery waistcoat, and, you know, it wasn't a very cool look at all, and he wasn't a very kind of cool person to be really into, even though I was. But as you say, time has kind of told a different story and elevated them and him, I suppose, to a different position.
He's always been sensitive, hasn't he, the fact that everyone looks at Lennon, the great bohemian, and Paul is quite insistent that, I was the one into avant-garde, and I was the one into Stockhausen and strange music, strange sounds and experimental stuff, more than him. Yeah. I can understand why he's kind of peeved, but he does sometimes protest too much.
Beginning in the 80s, he was, you know, having number ones, and he was just unstoppable. After Broad Street and possibly the Frog Chorus, because I remember listening to Capital Radio, and I think it was Roger Scott who was saying, I'm going to play this once, this is the worst song you're ever going to... And he absolutely tore Frog Chorus to shreds.
Frog Chorus was what it was. It was a children's song.
Yeah.
Yellow and Submarine. As such, I thought it was rather charming.
Absolutely. Yeah. How do we end up on Frog Chorus from...
You persist, don't you?
I do.
One thing is certain, you never give in.
I do. Moving on to track...
It's that kind of shite I have to deal with every day when we work together. That's what you have to be alert to the whole time.
I think you should do a podcast of all your off-air chat and do that separately.
No one would subscribe.
It's all gossip about ghastly people.
Yeah. It wouldn't get past the lawyers.
Yeah, I had to cut quite a lot out of some of these.
Do you?
Yeah. But they're the best bits.
Yeah.
I might get some... Can you have bootleg podcasts? I don't know. But, wow. Yeah, you do hear some... I would just end up in prison if I came out.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby.
Next we have Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, and it takes 1 to 3. There's no John on this. He's currently in hospital in Scotland after a car crash. I found a news article, because he was on holiday with Kyoko, her daughter, and Julian, his son. And he crashed his car. And I'll just read it out. It says, Lennon was known to be a bad driver and had rarely been behind the wheel since passing his test in 1965. He was terrible at navigating roads, had often failed to notice other traffic. The roads around Goldspy were narrow.
Goldspy,
is that? Narrow. The weather was poor. And on July the 1st, 1969, Lennon panicked after spotting a foreign tourist driving towards him. The Beatles founding member lost control of his Austin Maxi, driving it into a roadside ditch. And then he goes to hospital. But his quote at the end, Lennon remained in hospital for 5 days and told reporters, if you're going to have a car crash, try to arrange for it to happen in the Highlands. The hospital there was great.
Nothing's changed. Anyway. I've had a tourist coming at me on the wrong side of the road, and your instinct is to suddenly go to the other side of the road. It's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Imagine if that had been it for John.
I know.
History.
Wow. I digress. So, yeah, Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight.
I'm looking at you.
What do I think of it? It's amazing. It's kind of strange not hearing it without the... hang on, so carry your money, carry that weight. But then, dan, 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 you never give me... Without hearing that motif repeated. Yeah. But it's lovely. Just hearing it all building up and Paul's voice and experimenting with things. And is it just him singing Carry That Weight or is Ringo on it at this point?
I think it's him.
I have a thing about Golden Slumbers and the way he sings it. Because it's a lullaby, right? And yet he gives it the old, you know, old darling treatment, doesn't he?
Well, he's not a lullaby. He's singing a song about a lullaby.
Right.
And I will sing a lullaby. He's not saying, and this is
a lullaby. No. I get that. But still, look, you know, who am I to say he did it wrong? But in a way...
That's what this is for.
In a way...
It's a forum of honesty.
I'd love to have heard him sing it. Kind of softly, but
Golden Slumbers.
No, that's just weird.
Fill your eyes.
That's to my thought.
Do not love smiles awake you. You know, I love that.
Yeah, I think I do.
I think I do.
I'm not 100% right.
Especially where it comes on the album, the original album, the remixed album, the actual finished tracks. It seems to fit exactly what you were saying.
I mean, I like it
on.
When it gets to...
Retrofitting history.
Yes, exactly. And I like it when he sings Sleep Pretty Darling, because then I'm back into he's singing to me again as soon as he says darling. I'm, you know, it's a personal serenade. And it kind of softens down again. But I can't remember specifically what's different about this outtake. You're going to have to remind me.
It's just a sort of rough and ready
version of.
Yeah. There's a bit at the beginning where he's doing the piano and then he sort of veers into Fool on the Hill.
Oh, of course. Ding, yes, that's ding. Lovely, yeah.
Same,
and he starts
same inversion,
singing
it. Isn't it?
Yeah. And you realise how familiar
yes.
And similar they are. Golden Slumbers is a funny one now in this day and age because of, if you have small children, because of Sing. And that Sing is cartoon. Are we on that one? We know it? Do you know? You know, you see, it's too late for you. And so this is what they, in Sing. So all my kids now will say, that's the song from Sing, the little ones in particular, rather than, that's one of the greatest songs of all time written by the Beatles. Yeah. And that's another reason I get shouted at for singing it in my house.
What's beautiful about it is the run of songs which leads to the end.
Yeah.
And it's a lullaby. And it's the, I'm going to sing a lullaby. I'm going to make a heartfelt statement about, well, it's not a statement, it's just a feeling about the fact that we're near the end.
But we're putting you to bed. We're putting you to bed now. This is all going to finish. We're tucking you up.
We're tucking our time together up as Beatles.
That once there was a way to get back home. And it just, because all this whole album feels like a homecoming, of course it does. But it's, as you say, it's that retrofitting once again.
Here comes the sun, doo doo doo. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's alright.
Next we have it. Here comes the sun, take 9. Still no John. He'll be back soon. And this was recorded during Ringo's 29th birthday.
Old man.
Listening to the actual track on the album, I think what comes through more than ever before are the backing vocals, the BVs, with Paul and George. And it's that, we've discussed this before actually, there are points on Sgt. Pepper where they're all sort of integrated with each other. You don't know who's singing.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And it's like that with Paul and George. They can just merge their voices into a glorious thing that is greater than the sum of the parts. And I was really struck listening to Here Comes the Sun on the remix. It's just beautiful. I remember Simon Spence, who wrote a book about the Bay City Rollers, and this applies to Because, of the luscious, intricate harmonies in Because. Simon was telling me that, I met him, we discussed all sorts of stuff, and in the book he wrote a very interesting thing, that when the Bay City Rollers recorded Bye Bye Baby, which had some quite intricate harmonies, the original song by Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons, bye bye baby, baby goodbye, baby, baby, bye bye. It took them 4 weeks.
Wow. What, to get the harmonies?
Yeah, to get them right.
Blimey.
Just, look, you do that bit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You do that bit. No. Just try it again. Try it again. And yeah, that big hit with it, which was great. But you know that they would have got it immediately and done a few takes and it's there forever.
I don't know what it is, but that it has warmth in it anyway, but George Martin just kind of, you know, turns the warmth up to 11, because you do feel like you're being bathed in sun when you listen to this song, but not so much as Nicky rightly identifies on the stripped down version, and I suppose it makes you appreciate the layers that were later added.
Yeah,
I listened to it. I bought it from Bruce's record shop in Edinburgh in 1975, not long after I'd discovered the Beatles. I remember bringing it home, putting it on my little box player. I used to get an arm came across and you could stack your singles up and they'd drop one by one.
Oh, yeah.
Got it upstairs, actually. And I remember putting it on and listening to it and could not believe what I was hearing. I listened to it again and again and again. And then side two. Again and again and again. It's one of the high achievements of British culture of the 20th century.
Bing bang, Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon his head. Bang bang, Maxwell's silver hammer made sure that he was dead.
Now we move on to take 12. Of Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
There's a good bit of Paul bossing Ringo around on the drums at the start, where he sounds ever so slightly grumpy. And I feel a bit sorry for Ringo.
Ringo is just sort of like the mediator between these huge egos.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a bit of piss taking, I think, sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's Paul basically. What's he saying? I want more of this, more of this. It just sounds a bit...
Doom,
a,
doom, yeah. Ba-da-ba-doom.
Yeah, and yeah. He's been quite prescriptive
yeah.
of Ringo,
yeah.
which must have been irksome. But maybe it wasn't. Maybe he was called that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I suppose it's his song, so yeah. he's got a really clear vision in his head of what he wants.
Yeah, they did quite a lot of takes of this. I think this could be, you know, in... A lot of people said that Yoko is the one that split the Beatles. I've got a theory that this song they just kept doing over and over.
Do you know,
and
it was very appropriate, by the way, as we discussed this, that Maxwell the dog gave a little groan over there, a little sleepy.
Yeah, you all right, boy? Maxwell?
He's an old dog, he's asleep.
Kill him.
Was he named after the song?
He was named after the song and also Gavin Maxwell, the writer. So you were both, weren't you? Hey?
Well, here he is. Hello.
Talking about you.
I think he was rather enamoured with the song, Paul. I think he was rather in love with the lyrics. Back in school again. Here's the fool again.
Yeah.
He must have written it and thought, oh, yeah, that's nice. Those couplets are nice.
He's kind of playing around with the lyrics. I think he knows about halfway through this isn't going to be a take they're going to use.
It's not the finished article, is it?
Yeah, he's playing around with other...
Do you like it, Maxwell Silverhammer?
I can't stand it. The one song... I love all the Beatles songs. This is the one I can't handle.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't think there'd ever be a Beatles song you'd say that about, Chris.
Yeah.
But this one falls into that category. Is it worse than Don't Pass Me By?
Don't Pass Me By took 4 years to record. Write 5 years, I think it was.
Good Lord!
There was an interview.
It's not Rhapsody in Blue, is it? Goodness me!
Yeah, and I think this is one. But Paul wouldn't let this go. I think during the Let It Be sessions, they kept doing it, and you can see the footage, and they're like, again, and they're kind of losing faith in it. But Paul's completely oblivious, and he's, yeah, come on, lads, let's do it one more time. And I think it's
a great bass run by George at 3 minutes and 14 seconds.
Yes. Got to explain that for me.
George does something exquisite on the bass guitar.
Why is George playing the bass on this?
He did, because they did switch around on this. Right. I don't think John was here for this either. So
right.
Paul will be doing the piano.
Right.
And then George plays bass on a few on here as well.
Ah, okay.
Because John wasn't here for much of them.
Mm.
The end's great, though.
What happens at the end?
Yeah.
The banter.
What? Remind me.
So, Paul says something like, "So I like that one, but I like the other one." And there's a bit of George Martin, I think, in the background. He says, "So we take the good bits from that, and then the other bits from the bad bits, or something." And then George Harrison says something amusing about the bad bits taking the bad bits, or something like that. And then Ringo says, "George Harrison's resting his arm." And then Paul says, "Let it be known unto the people."
Yeah.
And they all have a laugh. I love that bit. I think it's my favourite bit of banter on the whole record.
It's nice to hear them in just... You know, I would buy an album of just Beatles chatting in the studio. Just, it's nice to... Especially at this point, when historically it's, they hated each other. They don't, do they? They clearly get on really well.
Well, they hide it well if they do.
Stop.
He shut his eyes and came out on Where No Shut Balls.
Don't worry if you don't get the vocal, just keep on.
Okay, sorry. Yes. I get very involved, you know. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
And next we have Come Together, take 5. John's back from hospital and Yoko's in bed in the studio.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, they brought a bed in for her.
Big thumbs up from me.
I mean, again, a bit like I Want You, I just love Strip Back John, which you get again on this one, don't you? I don't know. I know a lot of people love this song. I don't think it is one of my favourites. But I like, I can't quite remember the specifics of what's...
Do you want to hear a bit?
Yeah.
Because the thing for me is his voice is shot to bits on this.
Yeah.
And it's...
I've got my speaker if you want.
But I didn't realise that was after the accident. So that explains it. I thought it was just him kind of vocally worn out.
And I think heroin as well might have played a...
Oh, okay. Not just hospital morphine.
What bit do you want to hear?
Oh, you've got it on that? Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Just to hear his vocals, I think. Because he starts off pretty powerful and then it just... He's literally gasping the words out at the end.
But he's holding back. And he says, I can't hold back. I get too involved. Because I think Paul in the background or somebody says, look, hold back, this is not going to be the vocal take.
That's right, yeah.
You know, just take it easy. But he can't take it easy because
That's the line, that's the bit. I get too involved.
Yes, yeah.
But there's a lovely...
But you're saying he was off his head at the time anyway.
Again, this...
He shut his eyes and came out on Where No Shoot Balls. Okay, sorry.
Just keep on.
Yes. I get very involved, you know. One, two, three, four.
Interestingly, when I interviewed Giles Martin, I said, oh, I love the way on the original record that it goes shum, shum, shum. It goes from one side of the speaker to the other speaker. And he said, it doesn't. I said, what do you mean it doesn't? I listened to it for years. My friend's dad in Edinburgh had the most amazing vinyl stereo system. We sat there in the middle and it went through our heads. He said, it doesn't. You think it does.
It does now on the remastered
version. It does
version.
Now.
Yeah, doesn't it? But
I think he was saying he's remixed it as we perceived it. Yeah.
And as they intended for us to perceive it, presumably.
Yeah.
But I love this bit at the end. In roller coaster, he got early warning. He's got Doris Duggers. The self-deprecation here is great.
A man like him would have it.
Early warning.
He's got teenage lyrics. He's got hard rock bowling. Oh. I'm losing my cool.
And that's the brilliant bit from the outtake, because in whatever way he means that John is, and I love Paul, and I will always love Paul, but John is undoubtedly the coolest man who has ever, human, who has ever walked the planet. He just is and always will be. So I love hearing him say, I'm losing my cool. I think to myself, you will never lose your cool. You are the god of cool, and you ever shall be.
Tony King, who was manager of Jagger, Stones, Lulu, Elton, John Lennon in the Apple years, he was on a Radio 1 roadshow with Lulu. He's the most charming and urbane man. And I said, I love the guy. He's so witty as well. And so many great stories. And I said, of all the people you've worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of people, if you had to spend time with any one person, who would it be? And went, oh, John.
Brilliant.
John.
Yeah.
He said, John could be absolutely vile, but when he was on form, you'd never want to be with anyone else.
Mm. There's a lovely thing. Tony King did a voiceover. I don't know if it's used for Walls and Bridges, the album.
Tony did?
Yeah. And I haven't heard it for years, but he's doing this outrageously camp. He's like, hello, cowgirls.
Well, he is gloriously camp, Tony.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just the strangest market. It was going to be used for a radio advert, I think. And I think Keith Moon's, I think it was during the Lost Weekend years. Uh-huh. And you can hear Keith Moon laughing his head off as well, and John's absolutely wetting himself.
Well, he was called to a studio when he and Harry Nilsson, John and Harry Nilsson and Keith Moon and whoever else, were wrecking this studio in LA somewhere. And Tony was called in the middle of the night to come and try and sort it out. And Tony said, I jumped on top of John. John was raging. He was completely out of control. And I jumped on top of John to calm him down, and I pinned him to the floor, and John looked up at me and said, my dear, I didn't realise he was so strong.
You can just see it.
He said John just came back in that moment. John was back.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is the Yoko basically got her bed in the studio now while she was recovering.
I mean, that must have been strange for everyone.
I guess.
However kindly you want to look at this, you know.
I mean, there were tensions anyway, weren't there?
If you brought Tina into our studio in a bed, I think I'd find it a bit awkward.
You get on with her, though.
No, I do get on great with her. But I'd find that kind of just that presence there. And it's that thing about, you know, when we talk about that...
her brooding that, presence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
When we talk about that unique chemistry, but something like that is bound to disrupt it. You know, that very fine chemical balance, you know, and then...
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not one of those who blames the breakup of the Beatles on Yoko at all, but it was a curious decision.
Also, there's the, have you heard the Digestives story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, tell me the
George went crazy,
story.
Didn't he? What she took that? One of George's Digestives.
Right.
Yoko did.
Uh-huh.
And those little things, it's like when you've got a relationship and it's all tearing apart. And then somebody does something really trivial and you go crazy.
Yeah.
She took one of George's digestive biscuits without asking him and it kicked off.
I would absolutely have responded like that. I would have got furious. Was it a chocolate digestive?
Even worse.
Can you imagine? We've all had those moments in our own relationships, haven't we?
Yes, I know. See, now I'm picturing this, your show in the mornings. I've got just got like digestives, do not touch. It's just like
now with Nicky, tangent. It's if anybody moves his pen, his special pen, because he has his special pens, and if they go missing,
right.
Digestive gate so all over again.
The end. Where are the guitar solos?
No solos yet. So we've just got that.
Yeah, I wanted to hear the missing guitar solo on Here Comes the Sun as well.
I know, that's another one. There's a video, isn't there, of Danny Harrison hearing it himself.
Mm. I wanted to hear the three of them exchanging licks.
Yeah. Don't we hear that later on?
We do on the actual thing.
Yeah.
No, but don't we hear it on the long one? No?
Yes, because that's the early mix they did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is effectively two chords, but it's an outtake. So
it's got great. It.
Yeah.
And the drum solo. The drum sound is fantastic.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, now, Ringo was talking about that, wasn't he? Hadn't he got some new skins for his drums or something?
Yeah.
And he was loving it? Yeah. And he... I mean, I don't understand the technicalities of drumming at all. My son has just started... to learn the drums. So I played this to him the other day. I said, look, you have to, it's the only Beatles drum solo. So you have to listen to this and, you know, learn to play it yourself and appreciate it. And, you know, so I played it to him. I was like, what do you think? He said, it's trash.
What?
But then everything I do or anything that's associated with me at the moment is trash.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's par for the course. One day he'll understand.
Yes.
One day.
Is it 13 bars?
It is 13 bars.
Yes, it is.
That was what... Was it George Martin had sort of designated it needed to be 13 bars?
If you want it, here it is, come and get it. Mm-hmm. Make your mind up fast. If you want it anytime, I can give it. But you better hurry, cause it may not last.
Come and get it.
What do you know about Badfinger?
A little bit more than I did because I had to look it up and because I didn't know. I mean, I recognised the song, obviously, when I heard the outtake. And I was like, oh, it's weird, this. It's like a kind of updated Beatles song from 1964, isn't it? But I don't know a huge amount about Badfinger.
Fascinating.
Go on.
Pete Ham.
Yeah.
Tom Evans.
Yeah.
They wrote Without You.
Without You.
Harry Nilsson.
I don't know that.
You do know that.
Well, no, do I?
Well, I can't forget.
Oh, yeah, I know that. Yeah. Okay, I know it.
She knows it.
I don't want him to get to the big
Mariah Carey
chorus.
Mariah Carey's version.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a massive song.
Yeah.
They were a Welsh band. Originally called the Ivies.
Yeah.
And they were taken under the Apple umbrella. They were kind of, you know, they were a first division as opposed to a Premier League Beatles, weren't they?
Yeah.
Great, though. Pete Ham was a great musician, as was Tom Evans. Yeah. Both dead. Pete Ham killed himself because he was obviously had desperate issues, but also they were so ripped off. All their money had been stolen by their manager despite everything that they'd done and everything that they'd achieved. And then some years later, Tom Evans killed himself. It's a terribly awful story. And they were so talented. And I mean, this is, Paul knows this is a number one hit single, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's again, it's the McCartney at his effortless best in just churning out a melody with wonderful twists and turns and glorious middle bits and harmonies and unexpected bits that you think you've heard a million times before and you love all, you know, you fall in love with all over again every time you hear them. It's pure McCartney, isn't it?
Yeah.
And did they not think of doing it themselves?
No.
No.
Why? It's a clear hit single, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm glad because it feels all wrong for this era of the Beatles. I don't feel like this is a 1969 Beatles song. It's a 1964 Beatles song.
But then would you pick, well, for me, if it was Maxwell or this.
Just leave Maxwell alone. We know how you feel about Maxwell.
Yes.
Maxwell is, for me, part of the rich tapestry that is Abbey Road.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Baby Blue, their song, was bizarrely, randomly, played after the final scene of Breaking Bad.
Ah! Amazing! Yes!
Baby Blue. That's Badfinger.
That's a great choice of song.
Hmm.
The most like incredible kind of closing sequence of a TV series. That's a great spot.
And so it was a hit in America, I think. Recently, minor hit.
The one thing I'd say about this outtake is, again, it's another Paul doing everything, isn't it?
Everything.
He went in and just knocked it off when he was in. As you keep saying, he was in early every day, so he went in early and just knocked off all the
literally
parts.
I think it was a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And you can, I think you can hear him on here, right? Rewind it back, I'll track the next bit.
Yeah.
So he literally, however long the song took, rewind, bass,
the next bit.
Drums, and genius.
Yeah, he is.
Absolutely genius.
And it's quite nice, again, because you just get reminders of, you become quite blasé about how hugely talented, and I think particularly Paul as well, you know, he was as a musician.
They did it just as Paul wanted them to do it, because he knew how it should be done. Their song, No Matter What, sounds more like the Beatles than the Beatles, doesn't it? Wait till you hear the middle bit here of this. This is another big hit of it. Big hit for them. It's this harmony here. Good song.
Did McCartney write that one as
well?
That was their own.
I think it was their own, yeah.
That sounds like something from Beatles for Sale.
It does.
What it is. Da, 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 da. Or 8 days a week, maybe?
No, it sounds like... can't you see? That sounds like Drive My Car.
Yes, yeah, that's it.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's that same harmonic interval,
yeah.
I think, in...
But they didn't change, apart from the harmonies, they kind of did the interwoven harmonies. They stuck directly to Paul's. Because Paul's given you this song, don't change a thing. Right, okay. And it worked. Next we have Sun King, and this was a medley with Mean Mr. Mustard.
Was that the only part of this medley sequence that was recorded together?
No, they did other bits as well,
right,
and kind of glued them all together.
Yeah.
But this particular section, that was one long recording.
I mean, I just absolutely love it. And I think when you hear the individual components, it makes you sort of appreciate the construction of that whole second side, because you just take it for granted. It is what it is. It's Abbey Road. That's what we know how it is. But when you go back and hear it in these little chunks, it kind of makes you realise.
Isn't this great, this bit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's the segue. And that's all it was. That is all it was.
Yeah.
To take them from two such contrasting songs.
Yeah. And they are utterly contrasting. You know, Sun King is this sort of soothing, ethereal. Right, how are we going to get from that to me, Mr. Mustard? Ringo! Yeah.
But it's Fleetwood Mac, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Have you heard Albatross?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. It's one thing that is vaguely on my radar.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thanks to him indoors.
Oh, he likes it, does he?
Yeah, he's a big Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, well, he would be.
Bless him.
Should I cut that out?
No, that's fine. That's a meme, that is.
Mean Mr. Mustard, yeah. I think at this time it was still Shirley, wasn't it? It wasn't quite Pam yet.
His sister Shirley works in a shop. Yeah, Shirley and shop work, but I think Pam works better.
But his sister Shirley is quite hard work, that
yeah,
is, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It sounds like Dave Clark. It's like being Tommy in here.
One, two, three, four.
Polythene Pam, this is take 27. And you've got a nice bit of John at the end, ad-libbing the fab. Isn't that great?
Oh, that's great, yeah.
This has got one of my favourite, of all Beatles songs ever, bit of John vocals in, when he says, and you could say she was attractively built.
Attractively
it's the way he spits it out. And you can hear it on this outtake as much as you can anywhere else. And I love it. I absolutely love it.
It's like a classic couple of songs about picaresque cartoon Liverpudlian characters of their youth, isn't it? You kind of think.
She's a prostitute.
Yeah.
Polythene Pam, wasn't she?
No, I don't know if she was a prostitute, but she was
a lady
with loose morals.
Loose morals.
But we don't know who she is.
Right.
We know her as Polythene Pam, but she was a friend. John had a friend back in, I think it was 63 or it was 62, 63, who they had a kind of double date. Date's probably the wrong word. It's pretty well what you hear in the lyrics. It was a girl who was keen on dressing up in polythene.
Right.
It was one of these sort of things. So.
But you've nailed it on attractively. She was
a
lovely scouser. Do you remember when I was doing the breakfast show with Sheila and I was covering the World Cup in Germany in 2006, and this Scouse fan walked in. We were in Gelsenkirchen. And he's on the phone to his mates back home. He's like, I'm in Gelsenkirchen. It's like one of those.
It's brilliant. And if you kind of tie it into the story of knowing that this is the last album and it's a homecoming and they're tucking us up in bed.
Mm.
And it's just that really strong reminder of this is where I'm from. Yeah. And it kind of just takes you back to just something a bit raw and, you know, kind of dirty and grungy in Liverpool, and I love it.
Yeah. But art is not of the conscious, it's of the subconscious, isn't it?
Is it?
Great art.
Right.
It comes from somewhere else. It's like Keith Richards said in an interview when I spoke to him, he said, if anyone tells you they write songs, they're a goddamn liar. You light a candle and they come down from the angels. He's right, though.
Yeah.
And they're not thinking it through, but it works because it's in there and it just, you know, do you know what I mean here? I'm struggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Art is not conscious. It's deeper than that. It's kind of preternatural. It's beyond that.
Yes, yes.
And that's why this works in the sequence in which it works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just makes sense.
Well, no, they didn't sit down and say, we'll go A to B to C to D. But they just had a whole bunch of half-finished songs.
Something inside them sat down.
But, so. Yes, yeah, yeah, I understand. She came in through the bathroom.
The next bit is straight into "She came in through the bathroom window."
And if that is one of my favourite John lyrics, this is one of my bits of vocal. This is one of my favourite Paul bits of vocal, just because I absolutely love the imagery. I just don't know, the way he kind of punches in a completely different storyline, and it just takes you somewhere else. But I always, again, and you know, I'm going back to the kind of this, you know, the full stop on the Beatles story, but. That was, you know, it's Beatlemania, isn't it, that? And that's kind of extremes of Beatlemania, and it's kind of a reference to that. So it feels quite reflective in a way, and I don't think it was written by that. And again, I'm sounding terribly pretentious, but I absolutely love it. I love that moment. I think it's one of the most brilliant moments on anything the Beatles ever did. Because you got John going, you could say she was attractively, and then she came in through the bathroom. And it's just,
Soars him, isn't it?
I can't really explain it.
But there is no context to it.
No.
Because he was saying, if they kept Her Majesty in, you know, Mean Mr. Mustard, and it's kind of leading somewhere. But from Polythene Pam, what? It's she.
Yeah.
Polythene Pam, or it's not Polythene, it's just she, some random, love it.
In Polythene Pam, by the way, this exquisite guitar from George Harrison.
Oh, beautiful, isn't it?
Now, she came through the bathroom window. Blah, 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 blah. She said she'd always been a dancer. How many clubs did she work out a day?
16.
That's going some.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was 16, isn't it?
She worked at 16 clubs a day.
But is it? Is that what he says?
Yeah.
Maybe it is Polythene Pam then. So they say.
That was before the European Working Time Directive. This is what we're going to lose.
Exactly. I know. She'll be fine after Brexit, won't she?
It's like a zero-hour contract.
I love that. Didn't anybody tell her? What didn't they tell her? What were they supposed to tell her?
Monday's on the phone to Tuesday, and Friday's on the phone to... Oh, yeah.
Didn't anybody see her?
The last time all four Beatles were in the studio, because this is take one.
Of course, yeah.
For this recording of this track was the last time all four of them were together.
Yeah. And this particular version is just George Martin playing harpsichords.
Yeah.
John on guitar, and Ringo using. They're using Ringo's hand claps as a metronome.
I do you know what? I wondered whether it was actually a metronome.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's so precise.
Yeah.
But it isn't. It's just
That's
him.
Ringo.
It's actually slightly annoying, the hand claps on it.
Yeah.
But because it disrupts, obviously, but you know, I get why they're there.
Can we hear the vocals on their own anywhere? Are they available to listen to?
Yes. Yeah.
Isolated?
Yeah.
Where?
They're on Anthology 3.
That's right.
Yeah. And they're also on the Love album at the beginning.
Mm.
And, you hear those.
They're now, is it right, again, I heard this the other day, is it right that George did the harmonies? George constructed the harmonies for Because.
George Martin. What happened? John was... He knew how to do harmonies in thirds, but the chords here are so...
complicated.
Yeah, complicated, sort of classical music level. George had to help him out with the harmonies. Right. And apparently John was saying, oh, yeah, that one, we'll have that one.
Right.
So George kind of worked it out on the piano for them, and then they followed that.
And they disappeared down into rehearsal room, didn't they?
Yes.
And practiced it and practiced it and practiced it until they got it.
Yeah.
So I thought you'd bring up your diminished ninths here, because I know you love a diminished ninth. Is it a diminished ninth, or is it an augmented seventh? Or I don't
read music. I can play music, I can't read it.
So, But what I would say is that having done stuff in the studio with quite complicated harmonies and had an arranger to do it, a guy I work with called Paul Buck, and he's come there and said, when you hear it isolated, before it's all medged together, it'll sound discordant, but in the whole, it works perfectly. So it's such a complicated process, arranging harmonies like that. And it sounds sublime.
But very hard to sing, really hard to sing. And going back to what you were saying about how instinctive they were in their harmonising, because, and again, I mean, cut this out because I can't remember where I heard it, but I'm just going to say it, reference it to you. I'm sure it might have been on one of those Radio 2 programmes. So we're talking about like King's College Choir, someone like that was given it to sing, and it took them like hours and hours and hours, weeks, days to learn it because it is so kind of complicated. So it's, you know, even if you're a really competent singing choir.
They never played the Reeper Band. King's College Choir, did they?
That's the difference. But I can't. That's such a fudge story. Don't use it because it's inaccurate. But it's something along those lines, and you'll pick up that another time.
But yeah, but then also, as you
but
said,
but they had been. They were. What I mean is that they hadn't been together.
Yeah, in that
played bands, played bars, sweated, slept together, had the telepathy that the Beatles had with each other. Mm. King's College Choir.
It's very plaintive, isn't it? And again, particularly because, you know, I kind of regard this as something like a requiem for the Beatles. Like, I find it quite emotional.
Any jobber got the sack. Monday morning, turning back. Yellow lorry slow, nowhere to go. But oh, that magic feeling. Nowhere to go.
The Long One, which is supposed to be a trial edit.
Yeah, whoever heard this? The Long One.
Brilliant. I wish they called it that on the album. Called it The Long One.
Yeah,
is this new to you? You know everything about
it
this.
It has, yeah. It's been doing the bootleg circuit for
has
a while.
It? Okay.
And I didn't quite know because it was called the Long One on the bootleg.
The bootleg circuit. I love it. Like this little underground army of...
Okay. Scurry around by night. The main thing about this is... It's an early mix, so you've actually got Her Majesty is in between me and Mr. Mustard. So, yeah, I don't know if that works or not. It does lyrically, I guess. But
it tells you the story of how we ended up where we ended up, though. That's the thing. It's kind of an integral part of the whole kind of Abbey Road evolution, isn't it? And I think that's what makes it interesting, certainly to, you know, anyone who's slightly, you know, absorbed in Beatles stuff.
Your point about she came in through the bathroom window, which was beautiful. We forgot, of course. Oh, look out! She came in through the bathroom window.
Is that on the outtake?
No, it's on the actual...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah.
Talking of art, is it true that Garfunkel was at a party and George Harrison came up to him and said, "We both have a Paul problem."
Yes.
That is true, yeah. It's musical perfection.
Yeah.
It's the Beatles. The Long One. This whole sequence. I was listening to it the other day and I burst into tears.
Listening to The Long One?
Yeah, listening to that whole sequence up to the end.
Yeah.
The stuff going on in my life. And so that got to me, but this got to me in the way that, you know, it rarely does. There was just, I was feeling melancholy at the time anyway.
Mm.
And then I heard this, and it took me back to something that I love so much and something that has been with me for so long and meant so much to me. And I was hearing it anew for the first time. You always, every time you hear the Beatles, you hear it for the first time. But this was unique. I'd never heard it like this before, and I just find it emotional. As what you were saying earlier on, I just find it emotionally overwhelming.
But I think that about all of this and the whole kind of experience of listening to the remastering, but the construction of it that you get from the outtakes as well, I think it is a really emotional experience. And for people who are, and hopefully they're not listening to this podcast anyway, but who don't really get it they'll think, you know, this sounds like lunacy. But hopefully it doesn't sound completely irrational to people who are passionate about the Beatles.
This has been my friend for years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I see my friend in a new light. And my friend is wonderful.
Doing this, it's weird how the strangest songs mean so much to... completely with no context. It could be, you know, the silliest of songs. Mm. Will just get people crying. And it's because they've been with them since they were kids and they've grown up. It's like having a little invisible friend kind of thing, you know. And,
yeah.
Oh, you've grown up. This is...
but also, I think the other thing about, like, you know, mostly you think of a medley as being something that's quite naff, don't you, really? But this is the most kind of... And I mean, had this been done on an album before like this, like a medley like this of, you know, quite distinct, different songs, tracks?
Not in a pop format, no. I'm guessing.
Something I've always thought about Sgt. Pepper... before it's going into, we've just had to go up, got out of bed, dried the comb across my head. We go, and it goes, and it goes back into a crush break.
It's a mini medley almost.
Da da da, da da da, da da da. I always sing all of it. Lovely Rita, meet a maid. Lovely Rita, meet a... And it's always in my mind, it's always like the motif coming back of Lovely Rita.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which gives it a togetherness and a cohesion.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they've heard it and they've thought, that kind of works. It might have been unintentional. We just had that orchestral arrangement. And it kind of works. And they've done it here with You Never Give Me Your Money.
Yes.
But they've done it for real, and they've done it, you know, obviously.
That point about a medley, you know, normally sounding quite naff, but this is as far as from naff as can be.
Yeah.
But it's orchestral, isn't it? With the You Never Give Me Your Money coming back, and the arrangements which we'll come to. It's symphonic. Yeah, 5 minutes.
That's all you've got.
5 minute warning.
It's a 5 minute warning. Because Rachel's going to expire from lack of alcohol.
No!
Keep this bit in.
Everything is going to burn.
Keep this bit in.
Okay.
Five more minutes.
It literally will be. Right. We end with George Martin, and it's Something and the Golden Slumbers Carry That Weight Strings and the brass as well.
Nikki, I said to Ray, I said
Nikki
to,
said to me, go
in
on.
A mad moment, I said to Rachel, she said she'd had a stressful time or something and it had been crazy or whatever. And I said, what we're going to do is mindfulness. I did this thing that I took the orchestral version of Something and I played it and I played along with it on the piano. And it was just, it got me in such a wonderful place. I said, you need to do that. You didn't get it, did you?
No, I did kind of get it. I just thought most of the rest of... the nation wouldn't totally get it, who we also happened to be speaking to at the time. Because this was a conversation that did happen on air rather than off air. But I did actually, it meant then, Nikki plays piano by ear. I learnt it as a child, so I have to go back to the dots and practice it, which is rubbish. But I did go back then and I like got the music and I then went back and kind of retaught myself how to play something. And that, it was really, I haven't yet played it with, because I'm not quite good enough to play it yet.
It's just...
a long time. Yeah, yeah, but you say that, but I have to follow the dots and play every dot in the place where it should be. He's going to get to the piano now.
No,
oh,
just,
listen, here he is.
It's his out of tune.
That's it's very out of tune.
It's easy peasy.
It's not easy peasy. Don't just, say... to someone like you, exactly, it is, but it's not. It just isn't. But I mean...
sorry,
you know,
about the out of tuneness,
by the way. To give... George Harrison credit for the songwriting, of course, you know, fundamentally it goes with him, but that is the most sublime string accompaniment. And I'm not massively into, as Lennon wasn't massively into, loads of strings, but I mean, George Martin knew how to pitch it perfectly.
Yes,
just enough, not too much.
It's so low in the mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't hear the pizzicato bit.
Yeah.
But you do hear the pizzicato bit.
Yeah.
You don't know that you hear it, but of course you hear it because it's all part of the glorious whole.
Yes.
What do you think that pizzicato bit? You're very sort of musical. You understand the dots. It's really stunning, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. No. It's brilliant. And you're right. You would not have picked that out particularly, unless you were listening for it in the original.
That's great arrangement. It's unobtrusive. Giles told me that John very much and George very much let George Martin get on with it, whereas Paul was far more hands-on. Yeah. I just wonder, Golden Slumbers, the lovely once there was a way. I wonder, that was George Martin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's a composer. It's the most sublime bit of orchestra, isn't it?
Overall, what are your thoughts on this? Do we need a 50th anniversary of Outtakes of Abbey Road?
Yes. Oh, my God, yes.
I know we're a bit biased.
No, I just think it adds and it enhances the experience and it tells more of the story and it gives a more complete picture and it sets a few records straight about, you know, where we thought they may be at that time, but perhaps they weren't quite. And everything is nuanced. Nothing's completely black and white. And you can have complicated relationships with people where there are tensions and yet there's still that kind of underlying, you know, love and respect and, you know, brilliant synergy between people. And I think all that comes through. And I keep saying, I find it a really emotional experience listening to it all. Because for me, it's just about it's their goodbye, and I know it wasn't intended that way, but that's why everything it has that kind of bittersweet, you know, sort of experience hearing it all, and I just feel it's the perfect full stop, and then you kind of think, what would the album be after this? What would it be? What would it sound like? And sometimes I think I'm glad there wasn't one, even though you want there to be one.
About you?
I think that people will still be sitting round a thing like this. What is this? What is this? It's a mixing desk, is it? It looks like the sort of thing that Revolver would have been recorded on.
It's the early Moog synthesizer.
It is, yes. Not Moog.
People will be talking about this in 50 years and in 100 years. Once there was a way to get back homeward.
Nikki Campbell and Rachel Burden, thank you so much. It's been awesome.
Thank you, Chris.
And I'm concerned about your dinner.
Did I sound like a sap?
No.
It was good.
I'm very sappy.